Hello, hello, and welcome to the Shropshire Witches podcast. I'm Alex.
Mamie.
And we have a very, very special guest today that we are ecstatic. And in fact, had many mentions in previous episodes. And so the fact that he agreed to come on is just fantastic for us. So we are joined by Professor Ronald Hutton. And over this hour-long episode, we're going to be asking a number of different questions across a number of different subjects. And really, just because we're very excited that he's joined us, we're going to sort of just ask things at random, really, Amy, aren't we? We're going to see where this
Yes.
goes. And he's been happy to indulge us.
Yes.
Fantastic. Sorry, Amy, you go.
No. So I was just going to say we're very, very excited. We've been kind of talking beforehand about where to start, but I think a really good place to start would be for the Shropshire Witches podcast, would be to kind of get a bit of your insight into the potentially the definition or your definition between what a witch is, what witchcraft is, and what you would deem magic is, because it's such a broad kind of subject, and I'm aware that historically it's very different to what we would call a witch today. But kind of it would be interesting to get a little bit of your insight into how you would define a witch, perhaps in the early modern context or even today, and also how you would define kind of magic.
Okay, with pleasure. I don't have a preference for a definition. Instead, I work with any of the four different definitions of a witch which are circulating in the world today. Two of them are very old, two of them are modern, but they've been around since the 19th century. The two old definitions, which have bumped into each other like dodgems over the centuries, are number one, that a witch is somebody who uses magic, which I'll define in a moment, to harm other human beings. In other words, they're bad, they're evil magicians, they're enemies of society. And the other is that a witch is anybody who uses magic for any purpose. People who've used this language have often distinguished good and bad witches, or in their language, black and white witches. The crucial thing is that the first language, the negative language, regrettably, is the language which has been used by most people speaking English who've believed in magic from the Anglo-Saxon times to present. The second, more generous and capacious definition, tended to be used, or was used, by people in authority who didn't think that people should use magic. So what they were doing in effect was smearing good magicians, people who tried to use magic to help people, with the negative word witch. But in the last few hundred years, this usage of witch has actually lost its smear effect and become a genuinely neutral or even positive term, which paved the way for the two modern definitions. They're both 19th century and they're both very current, and they're both just as legitimate as the older definitions. One is that a witch is a feisty and independent woman who is persecuted by the patriarchy for not conforming to it. And the witch is undoubtedly a feminist symbol. The witch figure, good or bad, is one of very few images of independent female power that traditional European culture has bequeathed to the present. And the final definition is that a witch is a practitioner of a feminist, nature-based pagan religion. Now, all of those are equally valid at the present day, and I deal with each in the context in which I find it. Definition of magic. The one I'll employ is ancient, but enduring. It was first defined by the ancient Greeks, who actually invented the word. And then the Romans took it over and gave it to the English, or English speakers. And that is, magic is a means of manipulating uncanny power, that is, power to which most humans don't have access, to achieve results in the present world. That distinguishes it in the Greek mind and the Roman mind from religion, in which if you want something, you have to ask, and then it's up to the deities what happens. In magic, humans have some kind of at least enhanced control over the end result.
So this idea of magic being beneficial but also being negative, do you find, because of course, so when the I'm not kind of asking this particularly well, when the witch trials started, and this idea of maybe perhaps how a lot of us would see witches in that conventional sense, and the way maybe they survived in sort of Halloween, things like this, but this idea of magic, people using magic to benefit them, but then also seeing magic as a negative. Has that been something that you think has coexisted since time, or has that in itself changed in our relationship with people that are able to provide that service? So this idea of maybe going from cunning folk, or the idea of people actually doing things to bend at their will, that type of thing. Has that really been a long-standing relationship, or do you think there was a pinpoint in time where things really did start to change?
Both.
Okay.
It is a long-standing relationship, but also it's changed in popular usage in the last 200 years. The long-standing relationship is actually worldwide. It's found in every society where it's believed that there are people who use bad magic. And there's a polarity in that every one of these societies, and they're the majority of human groups in every inhabited continent of the traditional world. I say every continent, but I have to leave out Antarctica to modern times.
Okay, that's
And
fine.
the polarity is between people who use magic allegedly to harm others and people who use magic to help them. And although the people who use magic to help others, folk magicians, the kind of people we call cunning folk or wise folk in English, have an enormous range of services in every inhabited continent, in most societies, one of their key services is fighting bad witches, breaking spells, breaking curses. And so, across the world, in traditional societies which have feared magic, if you think you've been bewitched, pretty well the first thing you do is you call in a folk magician, a good magician, to rescue you. And it's only when that seems to fail that the process of witch hunting begins. And the process of witch hunting is usually launched by the cunning folk, because if they can't break a curse, the next job they're asked to do is to identify the bad witch. And a lot of the early modern witch trials begin with a cunning person making an identification of a suspect. And it's only after that that people move into the legal system. The big change is that in modern times, the figure of the witch has blurred so that cunning folk and the people persecuted in witch trials are often regarded as the same.
Ah, okay. That's yeah, we haven't differentiated them, and or perhaps it isn't a universal separation that we all have. I think is that's so
That's
interesting.
right. But in the past, this confusion sometimes did occur in that cunning folk who weren't terribly proficient, terribly successful, or who had made enemies, did get accused of bad witchcraft. But except in a very few areas, the Orkney Islands being one example, the proportion of people tried as bad witches in the witch trials who were also cunning folk is usually less than 10%.
Extraordinary. This, and we're passing around a little bit, but I think if you're happy, we're going to sort of ask the questions as we think of them. One thing I was thinking about that I've always thought is interesting, is this: when you think of a witch in terms of the physicality of there's an image, isn't there? Whether and you know, obviously, the better informed you are about these things, hopefully that idea doesn't always come to the forefront. But this image of a witch, and say the word itself, How long has that been the image that maybe, I mean, it's difficult to say, but if you said to somebody, whomever, out in a village somewhere and mentioned a witch, at what point do you think that was the exact image of physicality, this aged woman? I'm interested in the physicality of witches and when this became, even right through to more of the modern day, when it became a costume to be able to dress as a witch. It became almost an outfit. And the other side of that, I'm interested, Ron, to know is the what you think of this slightly more almost fetishized idea of it. When you Google witches now, you have to kind of wade through a lot of images of, as you do with all Halloween costumes and things, but AI images and this sort of overtly sexualized image of witches. At what point do you think there was a slant where, as an aside from technology, when that shift came into being as well, but the physicality of how people perceive a witch, could you tell us a bit about the history about of that?
Yeah, there are two bits to the history, and they are evil old witches and sexy witches.
Basically, yeah.
The evil old witches are ancient. Now, in practice, when you look at witch trials, the people actually accused only overlap with the stereotype. So, across the world, gender is one of the variables in witch beliefs. In other words, there's a worldwide belief, though not found in all societies, that there are wicked people inside a society who use magic to hurt their neighbors, often simply for the fun of it rather than any material or political gain. But the sex of the stereotypical suspect is incredibly varied. Along with other factors. So, across the world, in some societies, witches are stereotypically female, in others, they're stereotypically male. In some, witches are stereotypically old, in some, they're stereotypically young or even children. In some, witches are stereotypically rich, in others, they're stereotypically poor. The reason why in the English-speaking world, we tend to see witches as old women, is because we happen to be part of an area of Europe, which happened to be the majority of Europe, in which witches are stereotypically women. And they tend to be stereotypically old for two reasons. One is that people tend to think of magic as being a tool of the weak, the underdogs. It's what they can use to fight back. And elderly women tend to be the underdogs of a lot of traditional society. They're numerically overrepresented among poor local people. But this idea of old women as being particularly malicious is ancient. You find it in ancient Rome, for example, where a witch in the literature is stereotypically a middle-aged to elderly woman, cackling and wizened and physically repulsive. And this had a huge effect. Most people know the most famous witch's incantation in English literature, which is from Shakespeare's Scottish play, Bubble, Bubble, Toil and Trouble. Not many people now realize that in places in his incantation, Shakespeare was quoting from a Roman poem by the poet Horace, showing evil old Roman women getting up to no good in a cemetery together and producing this kind of chant. So that really is old. And it goes right down to the present. The classic costume of the modern witch with the steeple hat and the cloak is simply the standard costume of a 17th century English countrywoman, or British countrywoman, since it's also found in Wales. Nothing more esoteric than that. But sexy witches tend, they're much rarer in literature. They appear occasionally, but only as maids or accessories to the mature or elderly women who are the real witches. But they come into their own in the 16th century, and particularly in Northern Europe, where naked, sexy young witches become an art form, along with hideous old witches. They're often in each other's company. Because of the Protestant Reformation, which put a downer on the use of the Greek and Roman classics for art, Now, if you were a Roman Catholic Renaissance painter, you had no problem in painting a naked woman, especially an attractive one, because you could call her Venus or a nymph or something like that. But Northern Europeans couldn't do that. So drawing or painting witches became virtually the only legitimate way to show an attractive female nude.
That's
And that
fascinating.
again has come down to the present. I occasionally trawl the internet for current images of witches, and there is an absolutely enormous market in erotica of all kinds associated with witches. They're undoubtedly regarded as sexy as the present day. And this goes back to German artists like Olbrecht Dürer and Hans Baldwin Green in the beginning of the 16th century and the Protestant Reformation.
That's so interesting, isn't it? It's extraordinary. Bizarre. Amy, if you got, because I'm going to keep wading in with questions otherwise, so I'm aware.
So one thing I'd be interested to dig a little bit deeper in is the kind of, so I'm predominantly of research Shropshire folklore and Shropshire presentations and things like magic and things. And in Shropshire, there's a real difference between how male practitioners of magic or male kind of cunning folk and women's magic is perceived. So men particularly seem to be portrayed as quite well versed in occult tomes and, you know, being literate and having a literate form of magic, whereas women, it tends to be kind of more earthier, more natural based magic. So I'd really be interested to kind of hear your thoughts about that and see whether that's something that's kind of necessarily seen elsewhere in the history of magical practice. Is that something that we see extensively in between male cunning folk and female ones?
I think it's prehistoric again, because when you look at ancient representations of magic, it's accepted that men can learn magic, but they have to do it from teachers or books. It isn't in them. Whereas women seem to be regarded as much more naturally able to access it, just in themselves, which is why religion is ordered to try and take advantage of this. It's men who normally run ancient religion, presiding over the ticking over rituals of daily or weekly life. As priests, druids, augurs, haruspices, etc., etc. But women are valued for when the men lose the plot. In other words, when things happen they really can't explain or handle. And then women are resorted to as prophetesses or seeresses, like the oracle at Delphi, like the Sibyl at Cumae, like the great German seeresses, like the Leda, and the Irish, like Fedelm. And this, I think, runs through into the medieval, early modern stereotype of the witch. Because women are regarded as the more magical sex, they're also more dangerous because if they want to work bad magic, they just do it. And so they're more likely, when the satanic stereotype of the witch comes in, to make a deal with the devil to enhance something that they do anyway. Now, this is a particular view of gendering of magic, which is not universal. It covers most of Europe, including Rome, Germany, and therefore England, and large parts of the rest of Europe as well. But there are significant areas where ancient stereotypes were different, and so when the witch trials come along, it's men who are clobbered. So in Iceland, for example, Iceland has a vicious little witch hunt spread over the early modern period, and 93% of those burned are men. Because in Iceland, men are the magicians, because Icelandic magic depended on runes, magical writing, and men are experts in those. In Finland and the Baltic states, it's also men who are the majority, and also across most of Russia. In the Baltic states and Finland, because magic there is conducted by shamans. That is, people who go into trance to contact a spirit world. And most of those are men. So in witch hunting comes in, it's the men who are attacked. And in Russia, magic is dependent upon the knowledge of spoken charms and written works, and these are associated with men. So most of the people accused of witchcraft in Russia are male. And Russia's a big place. In Normandy, it's shepherds who are the magical sex. So in witch hunting comes in, it's the men, because men are shepherds. And in Austria, which again is a big collection of land, it's vagrants who are the magical people, the suspects, and they're mostly male too. Now, when you put together all the lands that I've described, that's a huge area of Europe, especially if you put in Russia. So the idea that witch hunting is woman hunting is only true in the majority of Western and Central Europe.
And so, if that's this sort of leads on to another question, if that idea that, as we sort of discussed, the female as the witch, which I think is interesting in itself, that that prevails more for us as an image ever than it does the idea of men. And you mentioned Icelandic witch trials. I wonder why, and I hope this isn't too broad brush, I wonder why some witch trials have or carry the notoriety, should we say, that they do in the way that maybe others don't. So, it's a similar thing in this idea of thinking about Bloody Mary and, her father, whom killed far more people, I think, than she ever did. I think that's right. I could be completely wrong, but I think it's interesting how certain, so the English witch trials of Matthew Hopkins, things like this, and you also, of course, have Salem as well, in North America. So why do you think certain witch trials carried more notoriety than others, that possibly maybe even more people were killed or just as barbaric, but have disappeared to the pea soup of time? Do you think there's a reason for that?
Yeah, it's Victorian and 20th century politics.
Okay.
20th century politics feeding off the 19th century. There are two areas in Europe where early modern witch hunts get politicized. In other words, they're hot topics for modern conflicts. And they are Germany and the English-speaking countries, and especially America. And in both nations, the same effect is underway, which is particular lobbies in the German case, Protestants against Catholics, and in the English-speaking case, scientists and rationalists against religious bigots of all kinds, but again, mostly Catholics or Puritans. And witch hunting is used as a stick with which to beat these groups in the present. And so Salem is ideal because it is the one big American witch hunt, American in the sense of European colonies. And in the English case, Matthew Hopkins is by far the biggest witch trials or group of witch trials. Followed by other notable trials like Pendle and some of the Elizabethan Essex cases. And that's why these get star billing. In other parts of Europe, the witch trials weren't politicized in the 19th century, and so they were less significant and didn't go into popular culture.
How interesting. That's extraordinary. One thing I'm also fascinated by as well is in Ireland, this idea, this relationship with magic, which they seem to have in, and I used to live in Dublin, and I found that certainly when I was there, their relationship with magic is much more open, and they seem to have maybe more of a genuine belief in it than just a superstition, if that seems fair. And this idea of things like fairy roads. And I did watch an interview with you a while ago mentioning Lanon Shea. Am I saying that correctly?
It's more she than shay, but you're
Duke.
pretty well there.
Close enough. I'm happy with that. This idea of fairies. And I wonder if you could explain to us more of the Irish idea of a fairy and why perhaps something like that seems so, again, exclusive to Ireland. And it's the way it's survived, particularly when you go into rural parts of Ireland, still today. They're sort of, I know that a lot of their culture, they carry a lot of superstitions and things like that, but fairies have sort of held this real benchmark in Irish culture, which I find so interesting. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the history of that and your sort of thoughts on that as well.
Well, everything you've said is correct, except it's not peculiarly Irish.
Okay.
To go big, to go wide for a moment, it's also worldwide. I said that most human societies in every continent hunt witches, regrettably, traditionally. But in every inhabited continent, there's a minority of cultures that don't. And that's not because they're more easygoing, it's because they blame uncanny misfortune on other targets. They don't blame living humans. And in all these places, the choice of substitute is always one of two groups. Either you blame malicious or angry land spirits, the people you'd call fairies in Ireland, or the Sidhe. And or else you blame angry dead human beings. You've offended the ghosts or the ancestors. And so you have to deal with each of these eventualities. And there's quite a collectively a large number of societies that have these beliefs. The biggest witch-free area of the planet is Siberia, which is a third of the Northern Hemisphere.
Gosh.
And so native Siberian peoples do not fear or hunt witches. They really fear the spirits of the land. It's quite a harsh land. And they have good magicians, shamans, who deal with them. But it's not a witch hunting area. And not just Ireland, but all the Celtic cultures of the British Isles have this in common. I have argued, and I seem to have won the argument, that the Welsh, the Manx, and the Highland and Island Scots, or Highland and Hebridean Scots, all alike tend to blame uncanny misfortune on fairies. And where it is blamed on humans, it's regarded as involuntary. They're regarded as having the evil eye, which can curse humans, but they don't really mean to do it. So in all these areas, there are no or very few witch trials when witch hunting becomes the norm for the societies that rule them. So you do have witch trials in Ireland, but they're always among English and Scottish settlers. You have an appalling number of witch trials in Scotland, but they're all concentrated in the lowlands and along the Highland line. They vanish once you get into the Gaelic-speaking areas.
Interesting. And the Irish fairy, because I wondered if you would explain. So your I'd be interested in this in perhaps it's too because I always think that we get asked this question ourselves, and I always think it's a bit more nuanced than that. So I'm going to throw another one in for you is, do you believe in fairies, which I don't get asked, but now you've explained the relationship with them, it seems it's we separate them too much, I think, in terms of how we see them. But do you believe that there is do you believe in ghosts, and do you believe in magic in terms of the ability to do magic? I'm interested what you think, and I know it's not always as nuanced as yes or no, but I'd just be interested in your view of perhaps ghosts, and also whether you believe in magic or certainly people's ability to do something close to what you perceive as magic.
I'm in the middle.
Okay.
I'm not sure as to the reality of ghosts, just as I'm not sure about the reality of deities or fairies. I don't rule it out. I've had some odd experiences, but then one of which to which you've referred, they're not decisive. They could have other explanations. And I have never seen any absolute confirmation outside the realms of extraordinary coincidence that magic works in the straightforward physical way. But I am absolutely convinced of the extraordinary and uncanny abilities of human beings. In other words, the placebo effect in medicine is absolutely proven. And there's even experiments that suggest that plants grow better if people invoke over them or pray over them.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, yeah. That's
At which
extraordinary.
point, yes, you are getting beyond the realm of what we would regard as the straightforwardly natural. But none of those effects involve the literal existence of ghost deities or fairies, which I don't rule out. And indeed, I've met plenty of people who see and talk to these beings all the time, but they're not apparent to others. So their literal objective existence cannot be proven. But the beneficial results of all this can be quite considerable. People who work magic ritually do often get to understand themselves better than others. And they sometimes do seem to have healing results. They do seem to achieve clairvoyance, seeing things that others can't remotely, hearing things others don't hear, which can be a help to them. The
Brilliant.
effects are limited. Trying to heal anybody magically is tough. It's always best to try a straightforward allopathic physical solution. It's when that doesn't work that you call in the magic.
I find that so fascinating. And there's something very enchanting in the sense of even sort of going towards ghosts, because in modern times as well, I think our fascination with a ghost story will never go away, perhaps in no small part because it can't be proved. But it's always interesting to me what some people find scary and others don't in a ghost story. I prefer subtlety in a ghost story. I find that something that maybe could be possibly disproved, but I find that a little bit eerier more when you hear sort of, creaking floorboards, things like this, sort of the alluding to a ghost rather than some of the more Hollywood idea. But it is still interesting, this idea of ghost stories and the way they've survived with us, I think. Amy, I'm hogging the floor again with questions.
No,
There's
it's fine.
so much you want to ask.
I think that was fascinating, and I think it's very interesting to explore the idea of magic and the things that are beyond our knowledge from the possibility of its impact on a person. I think that's really resonated with me through my own kind of research into these kind of things. It doesn't, particularly with ghosts, for example, it doesn't matter so much whether they do or don't exist. It's the message or the impact of that story. So it was brilliant to hear that. I was just wondering, I kind of if you could kind of elaborate on a little bit. So with regard to the witch trials, what would you argue would be the main driving forces for, obviously that's a very general and it would be different in different areas, but was it as clear cut as it was a religious thing? I hasten to say not, but what would you say was the driving force of some of the big witch trials?
Okay, there's one driving force behind them all, and that's fear.
Mm. Yeah.
Absolutely naked, distraught, propelling fear. But the fear concerned comes in two different kinds, two different chemical elements, and it's their collision from the 15th to the 18th century that produces an explosion and a bloodbath. And the two forces are a prehistoric fear of bad magic, which was discouraged by the Christian churches in the Middle Ages, but has never gone away. And so, whenever anybody suffers uncanny misfortune in medieval, early modern Europe who isn't a devout, well-educated Christian who sees that as a punishment for their sins or the intervention of Satan or God trying their faith, then they blame a witch across the areas in which magic is ascribed to bad human beings. And that's never gone. But what allows the elites or forces the elites to encourage it instead of damping it down as they've been doing for hundreds of years is a new idea which comes in the 1420s, which is that God has licensed the devil to tempt and test Christians by enabling some of the wicked people among them to work real bad magic, using demons as the instruments for that. And when this idea comes out, when it comes together, which it arises among wandering preaching friars of the new kind in the 1420s, in a belt of Europe that runs from northern Spain through southern France and Switzerland down to northern Italy, but not elsewhere. And the people who are preaching this agree that it's completely new, that their forebears, their parents and grandparents didn't face this threat. It's a new idea on God's part to prepare for the end of the world, to see if the human race is worth saving. And so it's an emergency. And this idea spreads. It spreads really very slowly, but it hits mainstream Europe when the Reformation occurs and the Western Central European Christian Church tears itself in half, and the two halves set about trying to annihilate each other. It's this traumatic catastrophe that makes the idea of satanic crusade seem much more viable. And so two things now collide. Wherever you have insecure, desperate churchmen and magistrates, mostly magistrates, not churchmen, who are anxious to save their communities, to please God, to purify the communities which they rule in order to fit them for salvation. The idea of hunting witches comes as one item on an agenda. In other words, it's almost never by itself. You also aim to annihilate Protestants or Catholics and Jews and vagrants and fornicators and adulterers and drunks. So witch hunting is part of the package. But at the same time, Europe is going through two terrible social and economic experiences. One is a boom in the population. So the population's outgrowing the food and the industry all over Europe. So poverty is expanding exponentially, and people are closer and closer to the breadline. Second thing is the weather's gone nasty. Longer, colder winters, shorter, wetter summers, less land can be farmed, which constricts the supply of food and people's incomes further. So people are being forced into a subsistence crisis at just the time when they're being infected with the idea that their traditional fear of magic has been supercharged by a demonic crusade to destroy them. And that is the crucible in which these panic fears are generated.
You mentioned the Reformation there as well, and one thing I've always been interested with, and I think I'm probably simplifying this, I'm going to imagine, but the relationship with ghosts, and I know we're passing around a little bit here, but pre-Reformation, there was a way of sort of, I suppose you could purgatory, all these types of things, and praying for souls. And I wondered how they rationaled and the idea of ghosts after the Reformation, how they sort of almost would have to, I suppose you wouldn't have to turn on a sixpence, but how you would explain away something like that. And you know, if you don't have purgatory anymore with a more modern faith, where are ghosts? I'm interested what your thoughts on that were.
Well, the answer is supposed to be simple. On the ground, of course, it's not. The simple answer is that ghosts could be credited by church and state in the Middle Ages because of purgatory, the idea that God might actually want certain people who are being punished for their sins to hang around on earth feeling rotten and there to advertise to the living that sin produces consequences. But these are not bad enough to go to hell, and they'll eventually get to heaven. But meanwhile, they're wandering penitentially. So, in that respect, ghosts can be credible. But the Protestant Reformation bins purgatory, as you've said. So, ghosts can no longer be believed in as literally the spirits of dead human beings. But since they keep appearing to people, they're obviously demons taking form of the dead. The trouble is that this doesn't wash with a lot of ordinary people who carry on believing that ghosts are what we traditionally take ghosts to be. They are spirits of dead humans, not demonic entities taking their shape. And in the end, Protestant nations tend to buckle under the weight of public opinion and begin to credit ghosts as being in some way related to the human dead, rather than all being devilish.
Okay, interesting. I wondered again, do you think any weight, if you think of those people that were the monasteries, the dissolution of the monasteries, and the amount of when there's that amount of bloodshed, and particularly going into the countryside as well, do you think that there is a sort of natural inclination in people that go towards ghosts and things like this? So the idea of haunted abbeys and this type of thing, do you think there's something of the sense of justice about it as well, that people think that maybe ghosts belong to that landscape because of what happened?
Now, ghosts are certainly bound up with ideas of justice from tribal societies in the ancient world onwards. The monasteries aren't terribly relevant because they aren't haunted until the late 18th and 19th centuries, where that's partly because of the vogue for Gothic fiction and the imagination, but also an increasing discomfort with the Reformation, which breeds the Anglo-Catholic movement. But the Civil War certainly did breed ghosts for pretty obvious reasons, and that is, it's the bloodiest war in our history as a percentage of the population killed, and the time when we were most militarized as a nation, possibly up to 4% of all adult males were soldiers at some time in the Civil War.
Gosh.
So that this it does make a really, really big difference. It also destroys far more than the wreckage of the monasteries did. Because the monasteries, most of them don't end up immediately as ruins. They get repurposed as homes and factories and quarries. Whereas the Civil War, in the very short term, destroys castles, mansions, and suburbs in vast quantity. And also, crops are burned systematically, livestock is hamstrung or killed. The devastation of landscapes is considerable. Houses fall into ruin because the owners can't afford to keep them up. Shops are closed. Fields grow wooler.
I'd like to ask as well. I'm going back to fairies because just while it's in my mind, I know we're kind of it's throwing everything around here, but would you explain to us about fairy roads? Because it's not something we've talked about before, but I think it's fascinating. And would you also be able to tell us how prolific they are in Ireland or in the UK? And just tell us a little bit about maybe if you've got another experience to do with fairies as well, because I'm just thinking of Ireland. So when I was over there, as I say, it was a big thing. And here we think of corpse roads, and I know that's a different thing, but things that are quite visible on the landscape. But fairy roads in Ireland really do mark the landscape, and I'd just be interested to know a little bit more about it.
You don't really get fairy roads in England. or Wales, or Cornwall, and most of Scotland there. You don't really get fairies in the landscape England. In Wales and Scotland, you do get certain natural features, like mostly hills or mounds, which are associated with fairies. But in Ireland, fairies are written into the landscape. You have fairy roads, you also have fairy forts and fairy trees, as well as fairy mounds.
And do you think, so your experience of it, do you find, because I think, is it right, is it either early in your career, but early on, you spent some time in Ireland, and as I say, is it Lanarkshire? So this story, I wondered, how much do you think people, particularly still in Ireland, do believe it, or how much do you think people accept this as just an old story that's been told in the way of Tin and Og and other places like that as well?
I think people half believe it
Yeah.
a lot. And this is not particularly Irish. It's found in most rural areas. I've rarely found a traditional farming or fishing community which doesn't have certain embedded beliefs that verge on the supernatural. I think the classic quotation here is from my friend, the novelist Alan Garner, who was famous for writing books from the 1960s onwards about his home area of Cheshire in the Pennines. And he has published, as well as told me, the story of a Pennine farmer from way up in the hills who used to perform a certain act of propitiation of the fairies, the land spirits, on his farm. And Alan asked him if he believed in fairies, and he said, "Of course not." And Alan said, "Well, why do you do it?" And he replied, "I'd be a bloody fool if I didn't."
That sounds very similar to a lot of, I think, probably our family's experiences in Shropshire, where there's rituals that are done that are half believed and kind of half not kind of thing. I'd be really interested, just sorry to interrupt there, Alex,
No,
just
I've been
to
asking too much. You go.
no to try and kind of look at the history of witchcraft. I know that's a very that's not where I'm leaving it. What do you think are some of the biggest misconceptions about the history of magic or witchcraft? Because I'm a teacher. I teach out religious studies now, but I've taught history, and I've noticed in my time there are things that students bring up, and it doesn't matter where I am in the country, they will bring up. So what do you think are perhaps some of the biggest misconceptions about the history of magic or witchcraft?
I think there are three, and they're not the result of ordinary people deluding themselves. They're academic errors made in the 19th century and then propagated through the early and mid-20th. Basically, the history the Victorians and their continental counterparts laid down for us is the history which was taught as orthodoxy until the 1970s, 1980s. So my childhood. The three misconceptions are one, that witch hunting is definitively a Christian activity and can be blamed on the church, however people define that. Second is that it's effectively woman hunting. It's a pretense by men to grind women down. And the third is that it comes from top downwards. In other words, it's a delusion foisted on the ordinary people by people in power, inquisitors, bishops, or magistrates, in order to make money and enhance their power over the locals and break the spirit. All those are really wrong. And they're actually quite dangerous because they are wrong enough to give us a false view, not just of the past, but of the state of humanity. And given the fact that witch hunting is still a big problem in the present world, in large areas of the developing world, and that there are lobbies in the first world, like the Deliverance Ministry in North America, that still believes literally in demons and witches, to mistake what produced the early modern trials is dangerous because, to put it bluntly, the eradication of official witch hunting in the Western world has been one of the great achievements of modernity. We don't want to go back.
No, that's fascinating. And certainly, I think I've seen some of that mirrored with some of the things that students have said to me, or when I've been teaching about witchcraft and the witch hunts. It's particularly the top down, the idea that there was these inquisitors and there was these people foisting it on others is something that I've seen predominantly in my time.
Yeah, we've only got a few minutes left. Can I ask you a couple of questions about you?
Yes,
Oh yeah, please do. Please do.
The first is, where are you based in Shropshire?
Do you want to go first, Alex?
Yeah, great. So I'm near, I suppose, place that you may have heard of, Bishop's Castle. I'm not
Oh
near.
yeah, I know it well.
I thought you would. I thought you would. I had
Yeah.
a there was a feeling. We're a sheep farming family from near there.
You at Mitchell's Fold.
Oh,
Do you know how close that is? See, now I'm getting very excited because Mitchell's Fold, the Ring of Stones is right by my house in Valley Knoll, and I do a lot of running and I go through there a lot. So
So I'm living in a village called Preston on the Weald Moors, which is near Telford. But my family originally are from Ironbridge, so I've kind of left the valley, but still within the wider kind of area.
So you both sides of the county
Yes.
see you because you proved yourselves worth it.
Oh,
Uh,
thank
you,
you. Thank
you,
you.
you dealt that. I decided you were decent people and worth taking extra trouble over.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah,
Thank
you've
you.
made my day. Brilliant. I'm so glad you joined us. Thank you so much. We'll let you get back to your very busy life, but thank you.
Thank
And to all our listeners, Professor Ronald Hutton, thank you so much.
you. Thank you.
Cheers.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Bye.